The Low Post is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on a Friday morning where we enter a weekend of basketball where it was so close to having both conference finals be 2-2, and instead they are both 3-1, which is still very exciting. And I wouldn't count either of those teams out. God knows I'm never counting the Denver Nuggets. The Denver Nuggets could be down 4-0. I would be looking for a loophole to make sure that they were not on the way home out of the bubble to Denver. So I will not count them out, although a LeBron team blowing a 3-1 lead does not seem likely. A LeBron team overcoming a 3-1 deficit, I think I've seen that one before. The Celtics down 3-1. They could be up 3-1. They could have won the series by now. The Heat could have won the series by now. The score of this series through four games is a dead even tie, 441 points to 441 points. So no, I would not write off a Celtics team who I think discovered some solutions to Miami's zone in the second half of game four, has Gordon Hayward back. That said, we have seen the Celtics already have a little brouhaha, let's say, after a frustrating game two loss. And when you get down 3-1 and you've lost three real heartbreakers, you just don't know. You don't know. Has the other team taken your soul? Has the other team taken your hope? Does the other team smell it enough that they just come out and stomp on your throat? I mean, there hasn't been a lot of that in this series. They've all been close. But you just never know. So it's dangerous to look ahead. But I'm just human. We're all human. I can't help it. I can't help but look ahead when both teams are ahead 3-1. Celtics, Lakers would be, I think, the sexier matchup. If you put all the league officials at the highest levels on Truth Serum, I think they would be dying for that matchup. Think about it. It's the history. It's the Lakers with an opportunity if they win the title. It would be their 17th championship, tying the Celtics for the all-time record. To do it against the Celtics, to stake your claim as the undisputed greatest franchise in basketball history right in the face of the Leprechauns. Although the Leprechauns, I don't know if they travel to the Orlando bubble, if they sit in the rafters at the TD Garden, to do it right in the face of the green jerseys. And yeah, apologies to Celtics fans. I think if the Lakers even up the championships, their titles are just so much better spread over NBA history than the Celtics, which are so front-loaded when there were eight teams and dudes were smoking cigarettes in the locker room. I think the Lakers fans would crow that they are now the undisputed best franchise in basketball history, and they would have a point. So that's sexier. But here are some names that I think you need to refresh your memory about. Some names that have been popping into my head ever since both of these teams went up 3-1 about 12 hours ago. Josh McRoberts, Danny Granger, Shabazz Napier. Those names mean anything to you guys? The Heat acquired all three of those players in the summer of 2014. As they were waiting on LeBron's decision. McRoberts and Danny Granger fit into arcane cap exceptions that the Heat anticipated having access to because they would be over the cap having re-signed all of the big three. They viewed them as fits around LeBron. LeBron famously tweeted a bunch of love letters to Shabazz Napier ahead of the 2014 draft, and what do you know? The Heat took Shabazz Napier. The Heat have always denied that they took Shabazz Napier because of that, but I find that to be slightly hard to believe. And the moment LeBron left, it created some hard feelings with the Heat, and I don't think they've actually hid that. I think that they have reconciled it, but if you remember the history, that series ends, and Pat Riley does the finals with the Spurs ends. Pat Riley does his end of the season meeting. He talks about being pissed, and he talks about having guts. And he says, quote, "Stay together if you've got the guts. Don't find the first door and run out of it." Hey, Riles. Oh, baby. A couple weeks later, goes to Vegas to meet with LeBron. Last-ditch pitch meeting. This has been well chronicled by both Wright Thompson at ESPN and Ian Thompson in his book, The Soul of Basketball. Maverick Carter is not at the meeting. Bad sign, number one. World Cup game on in the background. LeBron's paying more attention to that than he is to Pat Riley. Bad sign, number two. LeBron leaves. LeBron re-signs with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Here is Riley talking to Ian Thompson in the book, The Soul of Basketball. Riley felt as if he'd been played. That's Ian Thompson's words. Here's Riley. "Give me a heads up, and I'm going to be sworn to secrecy, and I would have started the work of getting players. Mickey Arison and I and the team deserved a heads up. That's the only thing that angered me after he left. That's the only thing. I had two to three days of tremendous anger. I was absolutely livid, which I expressed to myself and my closest friends. Wright Thompson, in a must-read profile of Riley from 3 years ago, has Riley talking about how a friend talked him off the ledge. Quote, talked him off the ledge from writing a Dan Gilbert letter. Although I don't think Pat Riley would have used Comic Sans. Flash forward 2 years, game seven of the NBA Finals between Cleveland and Golden State. LeBron trying for the championship that would vindicate his decision, that would cement his place in history, that would give Cleveland its long sought after title after 54 years. This is Riley talking to Ian Thompson. As soon as LeBron hit the floor, I sent a text to him. I said, win this and be free. He never got back to me with a response. In fact, he said something after the game. What he said after the game was to our Dave McMenamin, this is LeBron, when I decided to leave Miami, I'm not going to name names, I can't do that, but there were some people that I trusted and built relationships with in those 4 years who told me I was making the biggest mistake of my career, and that hurt me. And I know it was an emotional time that they told me that because I was leaving. They just told me it was the biggest mistake I was making in my career, and that right there was my motivation, LeBron says. Riley has denied that was him on the record. I don't know if it was him. I have no idea. I believe Pat Riley if he denied it. Point is, Riley got over this. The Heat got over this. They have sent LeBron many nice messages saying, Riley has said on the record, he made the decision he had to make for his family, for himself, for his legacy. I get it. I understand it. And he says in Ian Thompson's book, I'm a good Irishman, Riley said. I don't hold a grudge. Only the drunks do, and the Celtics, but not me. Maybe, Pat, but if you don't think the Heat have been waiting for this since June or July 2014, whenever they found out LeBron was leaving, if you don't think they have been chasing this moment for 6 years, envisioning what it would be like to see LeBron in the playoffs again. Now, they initially envisioned it a couple years later when they were in the second round against Toronto and had a shot to advance to face Cleveland in the conference finals. I don't think they envisioned this. Lakers Heat, 6 years later, cross-conference NBA finals, meeting LeBron at the absolute summit. But if you don't think that they've been sitting there stewing, that they've been sitting there thinking about what it would feel like to take LeBron out at the apex, you are kidding yourselves. Some teams, if you really had them in an honest moment, would say, "Boy, I don't know if I want LeBron in the finals. Like, I'd kind of rather have a weaker opponent. Like, could we get the Nuggets, but with Nikola Jokic injured or something? Like, we just want to win. I don't care what the circumstances are. We just want to win." The Heat want LeBron. And again, not counting either of these teams out down 3-1. I'm not that stupid. I'm just human, and my brain is a human being. Has been gravitating to Josh McRoberts and Shabazz Napier and Danny Granger. So if it's not Celtics-Lakers, yeah, maybe it doesn't have the history. Maybe it's not as big of a TV bonanza. But Heat-Lakers? I'll take any of these matchups. I'll take Heat-Nuggets. I'll take Celtics-Lakers. I don't care. But Heat-Lakers? Don't sleep on that. That's a fun matchup. All right, let's bring in Chris Herring to talk about the conference finals. If only starting your fitness journey was as easy as starting this podcast. The truth is, all the lift big, get big, and beach body ready in 3 weeks pressure stops most of us from even starting. And starting is what matters most. It's everything. Wherever you're beginning, wherever you want to be, Peloton encourages you to just start. With thousands of classes to get you moving and doing what you can. If that's a 10-minute low impact class, they've got those. And when you're ready, take it up a gear with a 30-minute live DJ ride. Start with Peloton and find instructors that will keep you motivated to stay on your fitness journey, learn the basics, and build from there. Remember, doing something is everything. Get started with a Peloton bike or bike plus rental at onepeloton.com/bike/rentals. Terms apply. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit,
your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, let's welcome in one of my favorite guests, one of the people's favorite guests from 538, the great Chris Herring. How are you, sir?
It's been a long week, man. Just a long, heavy week, but good basketball to watch at least, which I guess is some consolation
in this,
on a personal level.
In this world, you got to take your pleasures, your small, meaningless pleasures, without apology and where you can find them. I hear you, and I don't have any. I'm out of words at this point. I got nothing left. I need a little time. So let's talk about silliness, which is basketball, which is really what basketball is in the scheme of things. Like silliness, like, you know, this is what I do. Like when people start, like when there's a big scary story in the Atlantic that everyone starts reading, and there's like bad virus news, and then there's the Breonna Taylor dysfunction and all this. Part of me just is like, I'm going to go back and watch some film of Tyler Hero. Like, I just need to dive into my little rabbit hole. So we're going to dive into a silliness rabbit hole. Lakers Nuggets, the Lakers in just a grind of a game. And I mean that in as affectionate a way possible, a grind. Like, you got to earn every bucket, every free throw, scrapping for loose balls, all that. Took a 3-1 lead against the Nuggets. And that sentence, took a 3-1 lead against the Nuggets, I've now uttered several times in the last month. So here we are again. Of course, this is LeBron James. This is not the Utah Jazz. This is not a Los Angeles Clippers team that just melted down and suffered a total team disaster. It's hard to see the Nuggets climbing out of this. But I will let you lead this discussion. What struck you about game four last night, which I really enjoyed watching? I thought it was a fun game, even though it was not a pretty game. What struck you, or what are you looking for going forward?
No, I mean, I think the way you described it to begin with is probably accurate. It was kind of a slog of a game. When you get 60 between Anthony Davis and LeBron, and you look at the other side of the ledger, and, you know, this was not one of Jokic's finer games. He had five fouls, was in foul trouble, wasn't terribly, terribly efficient, wasn't killing the Lakers with his passing, wasn't out there as much as you would have liked if you're Michael Malone. The idea that you really had to kind of battle through this game, that Anthony Davis looked like he got hurt at one point, you know, pretty seriously, it looked like he'd been hurt a couple of times. And that LeBron is having to kind of take on the challenge of guarding Jamal Murray down the stretch. It didn't feel as if it should have required all that. You'll obviously take that win any way you can get it to avoid being at 2-2 going into game five. But yeah, I mean, it was a game that the Nuggets, that I'm sure they probably feel pretty sour about the way that went down. Looking at the free throw totals, looking at a couple of the plays where Murray gets blocked by LeBron. It was a tough game for them. There are a couple things though that I look at, and you know, something's kind of got to give with their situation. I love Torrey Craig. I feel like you and I talk about Torrey Craig a little bit every time we podcast. Feels a little
maybe a little
bit
too much. If you think we're talking about Torrey Craig a lot, there it might be too much Torrey Craig content.
It might be, but I mean, it's just when you look at the games that have been this tight now repeatedly in this series, and obviously the previous series, it's just kind of brutal to see him line up these threes from the corner and be wide open more or less. And you know, it's just nothing there. You're not getting anything out of it. And to some extent with both of these series, it just kind of feels like if you shift one thing in, you know that something else is kind of going to fall through. And I kind of feel that way a little bit about the Celtics right now too. But I don't know. It's just, I looked at a bunch of stuff. I was trying to figure out, you know, if you take out Jokic's foul trouble, how different is the game? Obviously a big question. Like you said before, I just think the Lakers are a different kind of problem for the Nuggets right now. The Nuggets were good this season when Jokic was in foul trouble. I think they were 25-4 when he had four fouls or more in a game during the regular season.
Chris Herring. You're bringing some stats. I didn't know that stat.
I didn't know that stat. I was kind of surprised to see that.
I'm not sure it's a thing, but I like it.
I mean, it's probably a better record than they – I mean, it has to be a better record than they had when he had less fouls than that. But I don't know. It just feels like something where, you know, we've talked about the cuteness of the 3-1 deficit that they faced. It does feel like they have a ton of intestinal fortitude to be able to come back from that. Twice, no team's ever done it. I do feel like there was a little bit of a feeling, though, that you couldn't afford to do that this time, whether it's just the other players on the other side of the floor. There is a feeling that I have, and I'm sure that everybody has a little bit, that it probably won't play out that way this time. But at the same time, you're not ready to just kill them off entirely.
As I said in the monologue, I am not writing off the Denver Nuggets until they board the bus to the airport out of Orlando. And not until, not even if they lose. If they lose game five, I'm going to be like, well, are they going to play again? I don't understand. So not until they're on the bus. So let's take your comments and go two directions. Number one, Jokic. Jokic in the fourth quarter of the last two games, 0 points combined, 0 of 5 from the floor, 0 free throw attempts. I thought also last night he was just flat out not good enough when he was on the floor. Dwight absolutely worked him on the offensive glass. You look at some of Dwight's offensive rebounds in the first quarter when he had like just seemingly 20 putback layups.
He was a monster.
Felt like, those were not offensive rebounds where he had some sort of spatial advantage when the shot went up over Jokic. They started relatively equal and he just rooted them out or just out-toughed him. And at least two of those putbacks came when LeBron was on the bench. And you just can't give them those kind of found money points when LeBron is on the bench. You just can't. And so, and I thought Jokic didn't get the ball enough late. He had Markieff Morris on him. I think they looked to post up one time and the game was already like 6 or 7 points by that point. And he missed a chippy and Jamal was rolling. I just felt like Jamal was rolling until LeBron went on him. I just felt like with LeBron on Jamal, that was a place I would have gone, and they didn't. But Jokic didn't really earn those touches with his play in the game. Now, you want to clown Jokic for 0 points in the last two fourth quarters? Fine. Clown him. He's getting clowned on Twitter. Fine. They won one of the games, so, you know, modulate your clowning for game three appropriately. Number two, Jokic is second in fourth quarter points in the playoffs. Now, obviously, the Nuggets have a large sample size of close fourth quarter games. He has 94 fourth quarter points on 33 of 62 shooting from the floor. So, like, I'm just going to take it easy when a dude has made a series-winning go-ahead shot and, like, a bunch of other crunch-time buckets. I'm just going to, like, dial it back on the Jokic clowning. Second point, Torrey Craig. More Torrey Craig content. What the people want. I deliver what the people want.
Go back and listen to our old podcast, man. We always manage to talk about Torrey Craig a little bit.
Hey, look. Maybe this is just all a ploy to get like a 3-hour exclusive podcast with Torrey Craig. Just like just all in on Torrey Craig. I thought the Lakers defense on the Murray Jokic pick and roll in game four was the best it's been all series. And the numbers, if you look at the tracking numbers, show when Murray shot out of the pick and roll, Denver was great. And Jamal was, I mean, I don't even know how he made at least three of those shots. The Jordan-esque layup. The lefty, like 12-foot leaning, whatever the f*** that was. And then the floater over Anthony Davis where I'm pretty sure Jamal Murray had only a vague idea of where the rim was and he made it anyway. But other than that, when he passed, they got nothing. Nothing. And I think a lot of the credit has to go to Dwight. Because Dwight, unlike JaVale McGee, can corral those pick and rolls pretty high on the floor. He doesn't have to drop all the way back to the free throw line. He can get pretty high on the floor, which makes it harder for Jokic to get off the pick and pop threes. And you've seen it throughout the playoffs. When Jokic starts rolling from three, it opens up everything else for the Nuggets. And he wasn't able to get good looks from there. And I credit Dwight for a lot of that. And what they settled with then was, well, we've got two on the ball, but Nicole is not quite open. So let's kick to Torrey Craig and see what happens.
Exactly.
Let's kick to Jeremy Grant above the break. And Jeremy Grant's had a great couple of games, but you're not going to be too stressed out about that shot. And the Nuggets just didn't make enough of them.
And that's the thing. It's three more games of that where even if Torrey Craig, you know, has a game where he can hit a shot, which it sounds really brutal to say it that way, but it's kind of been the reality now for a couple series in a row when you just look at what his numbers have been. You can get a game that way. You know, maybe it's him one night, maybe it's Jeremy Grant another. You get two games that way. I just think that 3-1 is probably too deep a hole against this Laker team, who, for all the reasons you just laid out, coming into this series, one of my biggest questions was, can the Lakers effectively play two bigs at the same time, one alongside Anthony Davis, and find success with it? Because throughout the season, that had not really been a thing for them against the Nuggets. Like you said, Dwight has shown to be pretty capable in different moments. Obviously, the work he did on the glass in the last game. So I just think the idea of three games in a row against these Lakers, and who knows? I'm sure we would have said the same thing against the Clippers last round. Obviously, that ended up not being the case. But it just kind of feels like they had to get one of these two games. Obviously, they lost on the last second shot. And then obviously last night where they're down the stretch and they're within three at one point down there at the end?
They were at least within two or maybe one at one point.
Yeah, it just kind of feels like one of those two games they had to probably get. And I mean, like you were saying before, Jokic, yeah, absolutely. You want to see more out of him. You have to be a little bit critical of him. But with the idea that he would have been the reason, a key reason, you know, that they would have won game two, was it, that Anthony Davis hits that three? So, I mean, it's yes. Modulating the criticism, I think, is fair. But it does feel like they probably needed one of those. I was looking at it yesterday. You and I both use Second Spectrum quite a bit. I think the Nuggets have shot above their expected shot value in all of these games so far. And obviously, a lot of that comes from what Jamal Murray has done by himself. But I mean, that's where it comes in, where you just say to yourself, they had to get one of these, one more of these than they got. And it just kind of feels like at this point, that might be too big a gap to cover. And yes, again, you know, it's cute to be able to say that now they've got the Lakers right where they want them. But it just feels like there's something about this that would be a little bit different, barring an injury to Davis or LeBron or someone important like that.
Well, we'll see how Davis looks in Game 5. I mean, he tweaked that ankle, and they tested it. If you notice late in the game, one of the reasons they went away with Jokic was part of that stretch run, Anthony Davis was guarding Monty Morris, and they were like, let's make this guy move. Let's put him in a pick and roll against a guard and test him out. He looked, you know, okay. But, you know, so to your point, for the series, the Lakers are plus 12 after four games, so it's been a competitive series. 118 offensive rating for the Lakers, 114 for the Nuggets. Those are both top two-ish or number one for the Lakers in the league for the regular season. So it's been an offensive series. Let's go to the fourth quarter, because LeBron in the fourth quarter, I just thought that this was such a grind out, like just classic playoff win for a LeBron team. LeBron in the fourth quarter, 9 points. Only 1 of 4 from the field, 7 of 8 at the line. And, you know, we've seen, like, he looks a little tired late in games lately. Like, he settles for long twos. You know, he had got Jokic on a switch and shot a long two. They had a shot clock violation in the half court late in the game. They had another just aimless possession with, like, 3 minutes left where LeBron just stood in the right corner, didn't touch the ball, didn't get involved at all. Ended with Anthony Davis trying to post up in the corner and lost the ball out of bounds. And yet they found a way. And the way was defense to offense. People tend to sort of separate. Are you good at defense? Or are you good at offense? And there is separation, but they're also intertwined. And the Lakers putting LeBron on Murray, which was a move I had written about going into game four and was waiting for. It wasn't just that he got two big stops. First one might've been a foul. Would like to see the old officiating report on that one. Might have been a foul.
I think we're gonna see a foul on that one. That they.
Well, do we get that public? Because there was more than 2 minutes left. Do we get? Do they make the whole thing public?
I can't remember. Oh, I didn't look at the timing on it.
I have to credit the NBA. Whatever they make public, they have made those referee reports so unintelligible with like 9,000 acronyms. And like some columns over here that are linked to some, like I can't even read them. It's like
correct,
too much mental
no
effort
call,
to read them.
Incorrect, no call.
A correct,
call,
no call.
Incorrect.
An ick, a nick, a shtick, a whatever. Like I can't, I just like, I give up after a while.
Right.
One of them was a foul, I'm pretty confident. But it's not just the stops. It's that one of them led to a LeBron layup. One of them led to a Rondo jumper. And, like, there was another possession with, like, 5 minutes left where LeBron got a screen from whoever poor Michael Porter Jr. was guarding and just got a little step on him and went up because he knew I'm going to get contact. And I know for sure the refs are calling it. And he got 2 of 2 from the line. They just manufactured points. And it's been a really interesting postseason for LeBron because I think there's the perception, David Thorpe has written about this a lot, that he's not LeBron right now. He's not quite the king that we've been used to seeing. And in the fourth quarters, let me read, if you want to clown Jokic, let me read you LeBron's fourth quarter stats. He is averaging 5.3 points per game in the fourth quarter, which is 28th among playoff players. Now, that's a silly stat because, like, Justin Anderson is ahead of him because of some random Brooklyn garbage time, okay? But he's shooting 42%, 4 of 19 from 3. He's shooting for the playoffs 19% on long twos. So the long two has totally deserted him. So I get it. He doesn't look, like, emphatic in the half court late in games. And the Lakers' half court offense has been just so-so since game one when they obliterated the Nuggets. You want to hear LeBron's stats for the full playoffs?
Well, you can read them off to me. I already know.
It's my podcast. Let me read them off, Chris Herring.
Fine. Go ahead then.
26 points, 9 assists, 10 rebounds per game. Basically a triple-double, if we're being, you know, generous. 54% shooting, 35% from 3, 63% on twos, which would be the best mark of his postseason career. Let me repeat that because this is LeBron James. The best mark of LeBron James's postseason career. 40% of his shots are coming in the restricted area. That's a higher number than in the regular season. So for however he looks in the fourth quarter, and I agree, the optics aren't like, whoa, LeBron. The dude is having another absolute monster postseason. And when the chips are down, yeah, you want to blame the refs. You want to say it's a conspiracy. Fine. Be that NBA fan, I guess. I mean, it ruined the whole game for everybody. I don't believe it's true. He's finding ways, and he's got the Lakers, and he and AD and the supporting cast have got the Lakers a win from the finals.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because I remember we did a chat about this at 538 yesterday. And I was kind of teeing up some of my talking points and some of the, you know, the numbers I wanted to use. And I was about to write about how gassed LeBron looks, which he has looked somewhat gassed in fourth quarters. But I think the only way to really characterize it fairly is to lay out what he's done in first halves that make his second halves look so un-LeBron-like. And so when a guy is shooting 70% in first halves, and shooting as well as you just mentioned around the basket at the rim, then it stands out even more when he looks as if he's settling for jumpers that he's not hitting, by the way, in second halves and in fourth quarters. You know, and we've seen that from him before. I'm trying to remember exactly which finals it was, but it one of the things that stood out to me so much when he was still in Cleveland, for instance, was there was that year where Kevin Durant had whatever it was with his foot or with this something, whatever it was, and he had missed like 25 games, and LeBron had played such long minutes, both just because Cleveland had kind of looked out of sorts at the end of the year, but they also struggled to make it through. Was it that Pacers series or whatever it was? LeBron had played such heavy minutes, and so it literally was just kind of this downward slope with LeBron's numbers from first quarter to second quarter to third to fourth, whereas Durant was getting stronger by the quarter. LeBron was getting, you know, he was wearing down. And so we've seen it before. We're wary of it. But when you're starting at 70, 80% shooting in the first quarter, you know, and you're doing everything at the rim and you're playing as hard as he's been playing defensively at this age, and we already know that, you know, the numbers and the plus minus numbers that we've seen all season about how the Lakers drop off, even when it's AD out there and LeBron's not there, he's doing a lot of the heavy lifting.
Well, you just nailed what to me, and I'm guilty of underplaying it too, one of the five biggest stories, basketball stories, in the NBA this season was LeBron buying in on defense from day one.
Absolutely.
And I want to poke around what led to that, because he didn't do this in Cleveland. He saved his defense for the end of the season in the finals. He bought in from day one. He has been outstanding defensively all year. I thought he deserved serious all-defense consideration. And he's just, people are scared of him. When he's rotating at you, it's scary. And he and AD on the back line, I think one of the reasons that Vogel likes to go big, and it frustrates a lot of fans, I've even said they should play Davis at center more. I think one of the reasons he likes it is everyone knows size, rebounding. But like, even when you switch out Dwight onto Jamal Murray, you have Anthony Davis and LeBron James on the back line. It's like, right, they can hold hands and stretch out their arms. They take up half the court. And right, you know, there was a possession in the first quarter, in the first quarter yesterday, where Murray and Jokic were running a pick and roll on the right side of the floor, just a little to the right of the top of the arc. And LeBron's man cut to the opposite side. And LeBron was like, I'm just going to stay here on the right side. Like, I'm just going to play a one-man zone. So it's man-to-man at the top in a one-man zone. And then AD's kind of tag-teaming him on, in the middle as a second zone guy. And you look at that and you're like, oh boy, that's a lot of arms and legs and scary dudes sitting waiting for me. And he's been outstanding, and he bought in from day one. And like, that's a culture setter thing. Like, when LeBron buys in, and I don't know, I mean, like, it's not that he hasn't bought in before. He's just getting up there, and he's third all time in minutes. He can't bring it every night. Nobody his age and his skill level has ever been able to bring it full throttle every night. But it really set the tone for their season, and it's continued into the playoff. That's where they make their bones. The Lakers make their bones on defense.
Right. I mean, we saw it. Hell, we saw it in the bubble. That first game against the Clippers, where LeBron, you know, just kind of locks up Kawhi to the point that Kawhi passes the ball out to Paul George, and then LeBron switches on to Paul George. And, you know, that it is a tone setter, but I think the thing that we saw from Cleveland with that, one, you know, Cleveland didn't have a lot of plus defenders on that team. But two, there would be those moments where LeBron would almost look frustrated, either when he would try to turn it on or when his teammates would like try to turn it on mid-game, and it doesn't work that way. You can't just decide all of a sudden one individual person or even three individuals.
That's a great point. That's a great point, because in Cleveland, there were eye rolls from LeBron sometimes. There were passive-aggressive aimed a lot of times at Kevin Love.
Oh, yeah.
That hasn't happened at all. This is like just a total human. Like, I have no reporting on this. I'm just interested in the idea of it. I just wonder if the moment you get Anthony Davis, LeBron realizes we have a chance to be a special defensive team because my co-star is the most special defensive player I've ever played with.
Yeah.
If we have a chance to be special, then I got to try to be special too. I have no idea. I've never talked to LeBron. I haven't talked to Rich Paul. I haven't talked to Frank Vogel. I haven't talked to anybody about why LeBron specifically brought this level of effort. But if I were going into those conversations, that would be like theory number one for me.
No, I mean, think about it. And now it seems weird to think about it this way. But I mean, the team that I thought, and I'm sure others of us thought, was most likely to come out of the whole thing this year. I mean, I thought the Clippers for a while were kind of the team to beat. It was rooted in the idea that they were going to be a better all-around team, that they had more ball handling, obviously, but also that they had two guys that were just stellar defenders. We know Davis can be that guy, and obviously we know LeBron is capable of being that guy, but does he want to be? And is it something that he really feels like he can afford to do? I've been someone that has always been willing to give LeBron a little bit of a pass defensively because I know what he can do, and I always wonder if he's holding that in reserve.
For sure.
Because, I mean, think about the play that to this point will define LeBron's career. I've always said this, is a play where he chases down Andre Iguodala, and you look at the offensive possession.
That's the build the statue play.
Right, and you look at the—I guess this was an offensive play, not a defensive one, but I look at the play before that, and it was Kyrie dribbling the air out of the ball, you know, and LeBron standing in the corner, which to me, I don't have a problem with LeBron not being involved in every single play because I know that he's saved. It's like someone that hoards their money. If you know they're going to do something really worthwhile with the money, So who cares? Not to say who cares, but obviously they have more rationale for not giving everything they have every moment because they're going to give everything they have at another moment.
A couple more quick notes going into game five. The Nuggets have to get Rondo under control. Rondo in the pick and roll, 1.1 points per possession when he shoots or passes to a teammate who shoots, 1.23 points per possession overall. That's number one among every ball handler in this series. They cannot get a handle on him. They cannot find a way to get underneath screens. When LeBron was resting in the third quarter last night, they ran a bunch of Rondo pick and rolls. He blew by Jokic in traditional pick and roll defense for layups and fouls. Can't happen. They've got to get it under control. And Rondo's been really good. He's also really smart. He's gotten two or three steals in this series with sort of like out of nowhere random double teams that have surprised the Nuggets. And again, the Nuggets turnover rate for this series, they've turned the ball over on almost 18% of their possessions. That would rank dead last in the NBA.
It's too high.
You can't give the Lakers that oxygen. You can't. You cannot give the Lakers offense that oxygen. And I thought the Lakers did a better job for much of last night running some sets on offense that got their other guys sprung open a little bit, some flare screens, some nice cutting plays. You know, that's always a little litmus test. KCP got some good looks. Kuzma got some good looks out of it. But they've just got to get Rondo under control. But any other notes you're looking at before we turn eastward?
No, not really. Everything else I had was kind of just on Dwight and how critical the beginning of that game was. Because, I mean, we've seen Denver's ability to come back late. But when you give kind of that big of a cushion up front and then you have to pull Jokic later in the game because of the foul issue, I really do feel like that was kind of the difference maker. Rondo has consistently been helpful for what the Lakers are doing. I think even more so than just a stat sheet, when we talk about LeBron and the fear that he's worn down or that he's going to wear down, the idea of having Rondo there just to facilitate just enough to where LeBron doesn't have to do everything, that's a big difference as well. But I think Dwight's minutes, particularly, it seemed like they took it personal as far as the criticism for the rebounding stuff the game before. You know, Davis
Oh, by the way, AD had 34 points and started the game like just like a fire-breathing dragon from all over the floor.
Right.
It was ridiculous how he started that game.
It seemed really clear. I try really hard not to get into people's heads as far as narrative stuff, but I mean, I don't think it would be surprising if these guys took what happened the game before personally. And so Dwight in particular, just kind of owning everything on the glass early on for someone that's not going to play a whole lot of minutes. I mean, what did he have last night? 23 minutes or something. So to play a chunk of those in the first quarter and really just to dominate the glass in a way that, that speaks volumes early. I just think that was a huge X factor.
Kudos and I'm interested to see where the Lakers. This is a grimy, tough, nasty team. Like at base, they're not pretty to watch. I mean, some of those AD jumpers are pretty. LeBron obviously is going to have a spin move and a dunk and all that, but like they're just tough. They're nasty and they're tough. And Frank Vogel has been a part of that. I mean, that's how Frank has liked to play since Indiana, like smash mouth basketball, all that. They've really taken to that.
The Low Post fans, listen up. Have you heard you can listen to episodes of this very show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership? That's right. All your favorite The Low Post episodes can be heard on Amazon Music ad-free. But that's not all. You can listen to other top podcasts like First Take and Pardon the Interruption ad-free as well. They also have favorite shows like The Daily, Part of My Take, and Up First, all without ads. You know what this means? Uninterrupted listening, so no more cliffhangers. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts, so we know they definitely have something for you. And it's already included in your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/low. That's amazon.com/low to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes! Catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them. You name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream. your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Let's turn to the East, where the Celtics are down 3-1. As I said in the opening, the collective score of this series is an exact tie at 441 points apiece. So on paper, you can't write this. On paper, off paper, in the air, whatever. You can't write the Celtics off. The Celtics have a chance to win the series still. They are a good candidate for a 3-1 comeback. However, we already saw them go through a little bit of strife after game two. Then they lose game four. Just every loss is just heart-wrenching for them. They're all close. They're all coming down to the wire. And you just wonder if, with the Heat close to the finish line, you just wonder if the Celtics have taken one too many really close, heartbreaking losses to feel deep in their soul like, oh, no, we can still come back and win the series. I think they probably feel they can, right? Like, they're a mentally tough team. They're really good. Getting Hayward back completely changes their team, and this will be his third game. He's getting his footing and all that. But you just wonder if they're down 10 in the third quarter. Do they feel like we can come back and get this? So I'm very interested to see how the Celtics come out tonight in game five. What's interesting to you? What are you looking at? What's some of your themes?
I'm curious to see in this game, do the Celtics end up, how heavily do the Celtics react to what just happened in the last game? By that, I kind of am curious to see what happens now. Tyler Hero just played his ass off, obviously. And to me, it's interesting that, you know, a game or two before that, you're looking at Dragic having played really well. Obviously, Jimmy Butler is who he is. He's not someone that goes off every game, but can. And you add all these things in. You obviously have Duncan Robinson that is going to patrol the, you know, is going to be along the three-point line. And, you know, the ability to throw Marcus Smart on people if they get hot is really great to have in your tool bag. But I just wonder, when someone like Tyler Hero does that, and when you're talking about your best five, and, you know, before coming into the season, maybe the guy that we thought was going to be their best scorer, who are you putting Kemba Walker on? And how do you kind of safeguard against Kemba getting lit up,
well, depending on who has it? This is what I said on my podcast on Monday with Howard. I said the biggest adjustment the Heat can make is you cannot let Kemba Walker hide on Tyler Hero. You cannot let him get away with that. And finally, we saw it in game four. The Heat were like, we are going at you. Isolation, pick and roll, whatever it is, we are not letting you hide on Tyler Hero. And so, you know, I agree with you. I thought Boston didn't play its five best players lineup, whatever you want to call that lineup. I haven't liked any of the names I've seen for it yet. I think they played it 5 minutes in game four. I don't think that's enough. Because the one guy you didn't mention is the guy that's been the electrical current, just quietly killing the Celtics every game and sometimes loudly killing them, is Bam Adebayo. Bam. He's averaging like 21 and 10 or something. They just have not had an answer for him on the pick and roll. They've tried lots of different stuff, lots of different coverages, lots of different help rotations. The only thing that has looked profitable for them has been switching. And I think if I had to guess what Boston's defense looks like in game five, I think they switch more. And that gets easier to do on two levels when you play that lineup. Obviously, you have four super switchable defenders instead of just three, although Tice looked good switching in game four. But when you have Smart, Hayward, Tatum, Brown, just boom, interchange, do whatever you want. It also gets easier to hide Kemba on someone who is not Tyler Hero or Goran Dragic or Duncan Robinson, who can just shoot right over him. When Tice is on the floor and you want to switch, you got to hide Tice somewhere that's not Bam Adebayo. And when Tice and Walker are on the floor, that has a trickle-down effect. It's just hard to find easy-ish assignments for both. So if I had to guess, I would guess Boston switches more tonight and plays that lineup a little bit more tonight. I think you're onto something.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I'm looking at tonight, is just the idea that Kemba, I don't think Tyler Hero goes off for 37 again tonight, but I'm not totally sure that he has to. Someone else can be better than they were in the last game. And really, in this situation, Boston has led for the vast majority. So it's really a lot, actually, like the Toronto series before. They've led 75% of the series. The minutes in the series, they've led 75% of them. But I do wonder at some point, is there kind of a confidence factor that seeps in because of how they've closed out these games or failed to close out these games where Miami has taken advantage and come back to win?
We'll see. I think the Celtics will come out and give a really good effort tonight, but I am interested to see how they defend Bam on the pick and roll because there's just been too many dunks, too many rim runs. He's just killing them.
Can I ask you something about that? I mean, it's so interesting. I just did a story on Jokic yesterday. The whole premise of the story was kind of to look at how dominant and how often he just stands still with the ball, where he doesn't dribble. He's just surveying the court, basically. I kind of assumed when I did a stat request to a researcher that Jokic would be alone as far as how long he stands there with the ball, how often he stands there with the ball without dribbling. Bam was actually the guy at the top of that list, but obviously Bam is a fantastic, fantastic passer as a big. Have you been surprised at how much Jokic and Bam have gotten these rim run looks and these 4-on-3 looks, and the teams, I guess you have to kind of trap Murray when he's playing the way he's played. I guess that, you know, at times Boston has felt the need to do that to Jimmy, which seems kind of misguided.
I don't understand why they did that to Jimmy Butler, particularly. I mean, that Goran Dragic dagger three came where they trapped Jimmy Butler, and Bam is like, oh, I get to play Draymond Green in wide open space here. Boom. I don't understand that.
I don't get it either. Does it throw you off? I know that you want to switch looks up as much as you can just so that nobody gets comfortable, but are you surprised that bigs with this sort of passing ability are getting this many 4-on-3 looks?
Well, I mean, for the Celtics, it's been the Dragic-Bam pick and roll that's been the big problem because you can't go under on Dragic. He's too good of a shooter, and he's really fast with the ball. He has a good floater. And they put Duncan Robinson on the weak side, so you can't help from where you're traditionally supposed to help, although the Celtics have dared to help off him a little bit and just flowing back at him with really great urgency since game two. And so it's just hard. Like, it's just like Bam is so explosive that if he slips the screen and you just throw the ball up, he's going to go get it if your help isn't on time. It's just really hard. But I have been surprised that, you know, the Celtics were a top three defense in the regular season. Like, it's not, you know what Bam is going to do on the pick and roll. Like, they've just got to be better. And I suspect they will switch more tonight in an effort to be better. But Bam has just been, and the other thing about Bam, you know, it's fascinating. He's sort of becoming, like, remember at peak Kawhi Leonard, there were stories written about how, like, he was almost becoming Deion Sanders, where the teams just wouldn't even look at his side of the floor. Right. Bam is like, here are some stats on Bam from this series.
Okay.
Boston Celtics isolations against Bam. They've only 15 in four games. 0.462 points per possession. I mean, that's just like high comedy. Like, you just can't. You can't. Wow. Jason Tatum, even you can't. Kemba Walker, you for sure can't. Ball screens, Bam Adebayo has faced 108 ball screens on defense. 0.787 points per shot when someone in the pick and roll shoots or one pass away shoots. Less than 1 point per possession. Like, you just... And I saw John Schumann wrote about, like... And this is because Bam can switch, right? You just can't run a normal pick and roll. He can switch on everybody. And John Schumann very smartly was like, there is one slight downside of that, which is that Bam ends up on the perimeter a lot and not at the basket. And if you drive it, you know, there's nobody there. The Heat have countered that by playing a lot more zone where Bam can hang out in the back. But even without the zone, I'm just like, I think Bam just taking you out of a very basic part of your offense outweighs the detriment of Bam being a little bit away. Like, he's just become Deion Sanders. Like, you just can't, Jason Tatum is an incredible one-on-one player. Bam is eating him alive. Like, it's like he's a big Deion Sanders.
And the thing, I think I downplayed it. I mean, I'd have to go back and look at our predictions at ESPN. There were certainly a number of people that felt like Miami had the capability of taking out Milwaukee, largely because of how good they are. And even, you know, that they had the possibility of leveling up a little bit defensively. What I guess has surprised me, and, you know, not to bank too much of it on this series, if you had told me at the beginning of the I guess the bubble or after the regular season bubble was over, that Miami was potentially going to be a game away, and you know, who knows, maybe after tonight, going to the NBA Finals out of the East. I probably would have disagreed, mostly because I just wouldn't have thought that they had quite enough offense to do it. Even with Bam being the passer, the creator that he is, even with Jimmy being who he is, even with Dragic having kind of, you know, I called it in our story yesterday, an ocean of youth season. You know, I just not wouldn't just have probably
he
completely
found,
bought it.
Found more water than a fountain.
Right. I mean, but all that, obviously Duncan Robinson. I watched Duncan Robinson before he was in the pros because he was a Michigan guy. I just still wouldn't have thought that they had enough offense to do what they're doing. I mean, they at this point, I know statistically as far as the teams being even point-wise, they're not steamrolling, but if they were to win this series, it would be a 4-1 win. They won the last series 4-1. They swept the series before that. I mean, they would have steamrolled their way to the NBA Finals really without a dominant offense. Obviously, they've looked dominant defensively at times, but it's a team that uses a zone, does it quite well, but is not shy about using a zone defensively. It just is such a – I don't know that we've seen too many teams like this, aside from the fact that Jimmy Butler is not – I think a lot of us would say he's a top 20 player, but he's not a traditional take over.
It's not close. Way better than a top 20 player. He's borderline top 10.
Okay. So not and none of that is to knock him as much as it is to say that if and when you wouldn't have him in that list, or if someone countered you about the idea that he should be on that list, it's the idea that he kind of he very much kind of comes and goes as far as he might not really be doing all that much as far as scoring in the first couple quarters. And doesn't feel an absolute need to close it out himself necessarily either, because he trusts his teammates and because he's doing other stuff. So, I mean, it's just such a – I don't know how many teams we've had in recent memory that have been kind of a stranger team than this Miami team. But I love that about them because it's unpredictable. You have rookies scoring 30-point games. You and I had a – not the last podcast we did, but the one before that – where neither one of us put Hero on our first team for all rookie. I don't really think he deserved first team necessarily, but I mean, is clearly capable of doing what he's doing.
Yeah, this thing happens in the playoffs every year where, and this has been a playoffs that was separated by 4 months of hiatus, where like right. All of a sudden Kendrick Nunn's out of the rotation and Tyler Hero is a monster. And everyone's like, well, how could these people not vote Tyler Hero first team all NBA?
It's different.
And it's like, well, I know that this recent thing is like at the forefront of your mind, but this whole other season happened like a while ago where Kendrick Nunn averaged 17 points a game or 16 points a game and started all these games and Tyler Hero didn't and like didn't do what he's doing now. So like I'm fine with that vote. The Heat are really I think they're a breath of fresh air the way they play on both ends of the floor. And like I get what you're saying about their offense, and I thought maybe they didn't have quite enough juice too once the defenses got better, but they were a better offensive team than defensive team in the regular season. I think they were like seventh on offense. Like they're just good. And you know, I said this a couple weeks ago with Lebatard. They can win the title. Like I don't think they'd be huge underdogs against the Lakers. I think that's a pretty good matchup, and I wouldn't put it past them to win the title. But the Celtics aren't done. What did you think the other big issue in this series? I thought the Celtics made real progress against Miami's zone in game four and got pretty much all the good looks they could want in the second half specifically. The one downside was they had 11 turnovers against the zone, which is just inexcusable, and some of them were just stupid. What did you think about that specific? And Miami played, I think, 55 possessions of zone in game four, which is just like, it's like college basketball all of a sudden.
Syracuse. Yeah, I mean, that to me is interesting too, because I think there's this thought that a lot of us have, the idea that if you use a zone, in some ways you kind of burn your ability to use it for the next game, particularly if a team does well against it. I think you mentioned 55 possessions that they ran with it the last time. So how much does that take away from your ability to use it going forward? But the truth is, one, Miami is really, really not shy about using zone. You obviously aren't shy if you're using it 55 times in a game. But secondly, they've got cushion here. They're up 3-1. If they lose, at worst, they're up 3-2. And the idea that you don't have to use it straight through, you could kind of try it at different points in the game. You can try it if somebody gets hot. And I think that's kind of the cushion that they've given themselves. So that's what I'm curious to see now is if they do that, if they're willing to do that. If they do it, does it throw Boston off? Does Boston have no trouble with it because now they've seen it? But even if they perform decently well against Miami zone, I would expect to see Miami roll it out again just because they really don't have that much to lose here, whereas the Celtics are playing for their season. And so I don't think the fact that Miami's back isn't against the wall, why wouldn't they go with something that they've had a decent amount of success with this postseason and this season?
Yeah, I agree. I think, well, I mean, obviously we're going to see it. But the numbers from Second Spectrum on the zone from game four, Boston 1.08 points per possession against the zone, which is solid. It's not great, but it's good. It's solid. And if you look, I thought they found a pretty smart solution to it in the second half. So a lot has been made of the Heat have it's a quote unquote 2-3, but the guys on the wings, which are normally their weakest defenders, often shoot up if they see a shooter there, which creates like a 2-on-1 on the sideline if you have another shooter in the corner. So what the Celtics started doing in game four was bringing Tice up to set a screen on the wing, and Kemba or Tatum would take that screen and go to the sideline. So two things have now happened if you take a screen to the sideline. Number one, going around that screen to the sideline puts the wing defender in a tough choice. I either have to shoot up to contain a good off-the-dribble three from Kemba or Tatum, and that leaves a corner shooter open, like Jaylen Brown got a good look out of that, or I have to sort of stay in between and just hope that Kemba or Tatum misses a good off-the-dribble three. Boston got great looks out of that. Their guys have also gotten smarter about when they catch the ball in that gap, fake a pass to the corner to get that guy to go back to the corner and then drive. The only problem then is that Bam is waiting for you. But I thought Boston in the second half got good looks against the zone, minus the turnovers, which were a disaster. And the Heat get a lot of credit for those turnovers. So I'm interested to see how that battle kind of goes in game five, because we will see, as you said, Chris, a lot of zone. And other than that, it's about... I thought Brad Stevens took way too long to put Kemba Walker onto Iguodala instead of Hero when Iguodala was on the floor in the stretch run. And I get that, because I think the thinking is we want to put someone on Andre who can rove a little bit and present a help threat at the rim, and Kemba's too little to do that. But I just think the damage Hero was inflicting was too severe. And so, you know, there we are. I'm excited for this game. I don't think Boston is just going to bow out here. I hope they don't. It should be a good game.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think a lot of people on the outside that listen to people like us all the time say that Eric Spoelstra is one of the best coaches in the league. I'm enjoying this run in part because you're kind of seeing how and why and where that's the case. We've always had to hear about, you know, the detractors that say, what did he really have other than LeBron and Wade and Bosh? This whole playoff performance, even in the strange year that it's been, this was a team that was not on pace for 50 wins that now will have steamrolled its way to the NBA Finals, and has done it by outcoaching a couple of really, really good coaches, coach of the year type coaches that make a lot of adjustments to what they're doing. So he'll deserve that, and it'll be a team that will have a more than a puncher's chance of beating the Lakers or whoever they play. And I think that's really cool that now we won't have to kind of ask, what has he done? He will have done this, and it's amazing to really think about that for a coach that, you know, came up from where Spo has come up from.
Yeah, the people asking those questions, if they're still asking that before these playoffs, they just haven't been paying attention. Spo's a monster. He's already going into the Hall of Fame before this season, and he's done a hell of a job. And these are two great coaches, and it's going to be hopefully a fun game five. I hope Boston brings it tonight. If not, we will have one finalist solidified, and then we'll have another game on Saturday, and we're almost at the finish line of this thing. The NBA appears to have pulled it off. It has not been easy. It certainly has not been easy for the players who have had, and the coaches and the people away from their families, the staff members. It's not a long-term solution. You can't live life like this. But apparently you can finish a season if everyone's willing to give it a go, and we're almost there. Mr. Herring, your work at 538 is always outstanding. I always love having you on. We had some technical snafus today, but we made it work. Enjoy the games, my friend.
You too. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.